is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Sometimes you need to take a step back and realize, hey, that I want my team to do this so well, but that's not what they need to be good at. This team's going to be really good because they rebound well, or this team's going to be really good because they defend. That's because that's who they are. So let me, as a coach, make them that versus molding them into what I want them to be. What three things is this team going to be really good at? And those three things aren't the same year to year.
Eric Gabriel is a men's basketball assistant coach at High Point University under head coach Tubby Smith. Eric was hired as the first ever director of video operations at High Point in 2013 and was promoted to assistant coach in 2015. Gabriel came to High Point from Shepherd University, where he served as an assistant coach. Eric also previously worked at Mount Olive College and Methodist University. He began his coaching career with stops at Alexander High School and Fort Loramie High School in Ohio from 2004 to 2008. Gabriel served as an assistant at Alexander under his father, who holds the all-time wins record at the school. He then became head coach at Loramie and won 15 games in his second season after inheriting a 5-win team upon his appointment in 2006. Eric was a 4-year member of the West Liberty University men's basketball team in West Liberty, West Virginia from 2000 to 2004. He was a 3-year starter at point guard and was co-captain his senior season. Take some notes as you listen to this episode with Eric Gabriel, men's basketball assistant coach at High Point University. Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Sign up now for their virtual camp 2.0 featuring 10 days of workouts with pro trainers from the Dr. Dish family. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hey, this is James Leith from Unleash the Athlete, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly. Mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Are you tired of overpaying for your video and analytics platform? Well, it's time to check out quickcut.com, a platform built by coaches for coaches. QuickCut is undeniably more affordable. It's all cloud-based and comes packed with features to help high schools and youth programs store, share, and analyze game film. Make the switch, get double the storage, and save your program up to 50% on the fastest growing video editing system in the country. For more information or to request a free trial, visit quickcut.com/basketball. That's QWIKCUT.com. Take some notes as you listen to this episode with Eric Gabriel, men's basketball assistant coach at High Point University. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel this morning, but I am pleased to be joined by Eric Gabriel, men's basketball assistant coach at High Point University in High Point, North Carolina. Eric, welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Absolutely excited to be able to have you on and dig into all the interesting things that you have in your basketball career and background. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about your first experiences with the game. I know your dad was a high school coach, so I'm sure that had a big influence on you. So let's talk a little bit about those first experiences.
Yeah, man. As long as I could remember, I had a basketball in my hands. My dad was a junior high coach when I was young, going to practice with him and running up and down the court when the guys were doing sprints, or you know, handling the ball when they're doing it, and you know, mimicking the way they shoot it, and just kind of learned by being in the gym with him on the side every day. I just kind of fell in love with it. I wanted to be there at every practice. Every time he had to go do something with the basketball team or the guys, I was tagging along. And I don't have my only brother is 10 years younger than me, so I was kind of an only child for those first years, and just gave me a chance to be around him all the time, because they couldn't say go play with your brother or sister. I had to go with him.
Go play with your basketball, right?
Exactly, and that was fine with me, and that's how I learned. That was kind of my introduction, and it just stemmed from there. I played all sports, but basketball was always kind of the foundation for me, and what I learned everything from. You know, that was the time I spent with my dad, and how he taught me anything was through the game of basketball.
Was there a player or two that you remember that maybe you had a connection with when you were, or were you too young at that point? Just what do you remember about some of your dad's players from that era?
You know, I remember a few that stick out in my mind that always, you know, there's always guys on teams that take extra time with the kids in the gym.
For sure. Absolutely.
And I remember those guys pretty well. I remember giving some of them free throw tips. Like I knew what I was talking about. at 8 years old, 7 years old, whatever it was. But I also remember those guys taking time before or after practice to hang out with me. Or I'll never forget the day, you know, back then everybody wore matching shoes. So the day we got, the team was black and gold. You know, we got black and gold McGregor shoes, and I got to be a part of that. Like, I'll never forget that. And that was kind of my introduction to being part of a team. Which is the better part about basketball, is being part of a small team, and then the basketball part kind of followed. But yeah, there's those guys that some of them are still back in my hometown today. And if I ever get a chance to see them, you know, it's always great to talk to them about that. Those times.
Absolutely. I think that the impact that a high school varsity basketball player can have on those young kids, I always talk to high school coaches about. I think that that's one of the things that, if you're going to have a successful high school program, you got to have that connection between the young kids. And of course, you had even more access being coach's son. But even for just a normal elementary school age basketball player to be able to have some connection to those varsity kids and just have something that they can look up to, look forward to, want to eventually be a part of, I think that's so critical to developing a long-term successful high school basketball program. Obviously, you can catch lightning in a bottle for a year or two and have a talented group come through. But I think if you want to have a good program, you really got to make that connection between the youth and the varsity program. I think it just helps out tremendously. The other thing that you mentioned that I think is interesting is just talking about the shoes and just how different the shoe game is today versus how different the shoe game was back in those years, where I always think about same thing you just mentioned, that every year, okay, what's the team shoe going to be, and where are we going to get it, and how are we going to make sure that it matches? Can we find, my high school was green, so how are you going to find shoes that have green swooshes or whatever it is?
Yeah.
And now it's just like, I mean, you look out on a basketball court and it's just a free for all. I'm curious, how do you guys handle the shoes like at High Point? What do you got? How does that work with your team? I'm just curious how you guys set that up. This is a question I've never really talked to anybody about, so I'm kind of curious how that works in terms of how your kids get to pick out their shoes and how that works.
Yeah, it's really evolved. And even in even over the past few years, it's evolved even more. And we signed a big Adidas deal about 5 years ago here at High Point, which changed our shoe game a little bit from being Nike Jordan before that. And when we went to Adidas, what we started as was a test school, and they would literally send us shoes that no one had ever seen. And we had to like sign waivers that no one could look at them or post pictures or all this stuff. And the guys would wear them, and then they would send videos back to Adidas and what they liked and didn't like. And then we got first access to those shoes, which was really cool. So our guys kind of had a little bit of a test run on if they wanted Dames or Hardens or whatever the case was. And then they would pick out that shoe, and then we could get different colors and, you know, have them send them. The way we do it now, Adidas is kind of went away from that, at least at our level. And we typically order a full run of their main shoes. So a whole size run for our entire team. We'll get a pair of Hardens, a pair of Dames, maybe a pair of Trae Youngs next year. And then after that first pair, which is usually in the summer, fall, they kind of give us an idea of what they like, don't like. And then we just order them that shoe, maybe in different colors.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, but the number of shoes these guys go through is incredible because of the amount of time they put in them.
Right, absolutely.
And between individual workouts and open gym and working out on their own and practice and games, and you know, it goes on and on. You try to get them a shoe they like and stick it, you know, keep them in that shoe, which isn't always easy.
It's amazing how important shoes are. I remember as a kid just how critical it was. Like, yeah. I gotta have these. I still remember my first pair of basketball shoes was a non-brand that my dad and I bought a pair. This is probably when I was in like third or fourth grade. And I remember we got them out of the bin at this store called Fisher's Big Wheel at the end of the aisle. They were called Super BBs. And they were totally generic, but that was my first pair. And I remember wearing those for probably a year. And then at some point, the Dr. J Converse were the first like real leather basketball shoe I had. I remember when I got those, I was on top of the world. And I could not have been any more excited than I was for that particular pair of shoes. And even today now, I'm teaching elementary phys ed, and I laugh because I was a classroom teacher for the first 19 or so years of my career. And when I got the opportunity to go and teach phys ed, I reverted back to being like a 15-year-old kid. So I dressed like a 15-year-old. I got more pairs of sneakers in my closet now than I've ever had, because I got a little bit more money than I had when I was 18 or 19. So it's fun. I can go out and, you know, pick some stuff out and whatever. So it's fun. People always laugh because they're like, got another new pair of shoes? I'm like, look, I don't have to buy any dress clothes. So this is where I'm spending my money. So yeah, the whole shoe world has definitely changed in a lot of ways from when I was playing, certainly. And it's a lot, probably a lot better for the kids now that they can kind of assert their own personality. It's a little way for them to kind of show a different side of them. And just the guys who are wearing the pink shoes or the neon yellow or whatever, and all these things. It always looks so different when you see them out on the floor like that.
Yeah, we actually, you know, it's crazy. You talk about the feeling you get of having a new pair of shoes on, and our guys probably don't even realize this, but sometimes if they're having a slump, like I'll slip a pair of new shoes in their locker.
Nice.
You know, cause then they come in practice the next day, or if they, the next time they wear them, you can just tell they're like, hey man, I got some new shoes on.
Yep.
You
know, like, no doubt. Exactly. You know, looking like, down at your feet. I remember that feeling.
Yeah.
Looking down at your feet and just being like, just keep checking. You're like, yeah, those are still cool. I still really like those.
Yeah. They feel better. You feel, it's like getting a haircut that day.
Yeah,
you
know?
You feel right that day.
Absolutely.
We use it to our advantage.
Yeah, there's no question about that. That's very interesting. All right, so let's go back to you playing days. When does it kick in for you that you want to play college basketball? Is it something that you've been thinking about just because you've been around the game? When did you maybe start to take the game at a serious level where you thought, I got to really start putting in some work and really try to improve? Do you remember, was there a moment, or was it something that was kind of always there just because you grew up around the game?
You know, I always thought I was going to try to play in college. I mean, I don't ever remember a time not thinking that. And for me, it was almost a little bit backwards. I'm very into the academic side of now, and having got my master's in coaching and having been a teacher. But at the time, it was kind of like, if I don't get to play basketball, I don't know if I'll go to college. And that kind of pushed me over the edge, but it was, as long as I can remember, that's what I was going to do. And I didn't really care where I went to college. I just wanted to play. My family, I was a first generation college student. So it wasn't like my family had any experience with colleges or how the whole thing worked. It was just, who's going to call me and offer me a scholarship or offer me a place on their team. And that's where I'm going to end up. What changed for me was in high school, I became a much better football player. I didn't put the time into football. I put all my time into basketball, going to the gym after football practice, playing open gym, playing fall leagues during football season. But I was getting recruited by some Big Ten schools to play football. So I was I kind of got torn a little bit there for a few months about, man, what do I want to do? I love the game of basketball and know more about it. But when a Big Ten school calls you, you listen.
Right. Absolutely.
and you start to think, well, man, maybe I should go do the football thing. And it just never was right for me. I never felt right about it. And basketball, some smaller schools, D2, D3, were calling all the time, coming to watch. And in Division I, there was a couple that I wanted to go to that I visited, and they just never pulled the trigger to give me a scholarship, which was probably a good thing for me. And so I ended up at West Liberty through different connections at West Liberty University and Wheeling there, which was a great decision for me and ended up being something that's very beneficial to me to this day.
Yeah, it's interesting. Passing up on the opportunity to go to a Big Ten school, and especially you were probably right before the cusp of social media where it really was taking off, where people were finding out about, hey, this and that and the offers. And I think that's one of the things that when I look at what's really different in the last 5 or 10 years in terms of recruiting and kids making decisions, and just there's so much stuff out there on social media that everybody can see. Mm-hmm. And you know it, that kids are posting, I got this offer, I got that. And I wonder for myself and for kids like you that at that time, you know, had it been, there been more social media, I don't know, pressure or just, it's interesting that you were able to make what ultimately ended up being obviously the right decision for you since you've now put your life into the game of basketball. But I'm sure there probably would have been even more pressure on you back in that time where, hey, I got maybe some Big Ten offers in the football and now I got to make a decision to maybe play at not that high of a level in basketball. There's just so much more pressure on kids today, and there's just so much more information out there that gives kids the opportunity, unfortunately, to compare themselves, which in a lot of ways is unrealistic. What we're seeing on social media isn't always what's real anyway. So
absolutely. I mean, I didn't even know Division II existed when I got to high school.
Yep.
And I ended up going to play Division II. I mean, I literally had no idea. I thought it was, you grow up in Ohio like we have, and Division III.
There is no, right. Yeah, there's no Division II. I mean, Division II, yeah. You wouldn't know anything about it.
No. So it was like Division III or Division I. That's all I knew before I visited West Liberty. I had no idea. So nowadays, there's no hidden gems anywhere. You know, you can find everybody at any point, anywhere. The last 2 years, if anything, with COVID proved that we can recruit without even going.
Absolutely.
You know, it's just a whole different world. So you're right. You're exactly right. The social media world has changed recruiting and exposure in a whole different way. And the pressure on kids today, you said it, is immense. And I can't imagine juggling the amount of communications they have, the amount of messages they get, the amount of just stuff coming at them all the time. Without any training, you know, we've been through life a little bit longer than them, and we've got a little bit of a base to balance those things. But they're getting all that stuff thrown at them from the time they got a phone, you know, which is at early ages.
Yeah,
now.
Right. Gets earlier and earlier yeah. Every year. We're one of the holdouts. Our family, my son is a sophomore, and he got his first phone for Christmas this year. So we have held out longer than anybody. And of course, he's been tortured that he can't communicate with anybody, which is probably right. True. Unbeknownst to his parents, it probably actually is true. And my daughter, who's a senior, she was a little bit more mature, so she got hers when she was a freshman. And then my sixth grade daughter doesn't have one at all. So people always kind of look at our family a little bit askance. They're like, your kids don't have phones? You're just getting your sophomore a phone right now? But we found that it's been a good thing, because to your point, the pressure and just what comes in on that thing, like obviously there's tremendous benefits to it, but if it's not utilized correctly, you can do a lot of things that aren't going to be good for you, both as a young adult and on into your adult life, as we all know. So how do you guys handle that at High Point in terms of helping your guys understand how to navigate it, how they should use it? And just, I can imagine the stuff that's coming at them all the time as Division I athletes, what that looks like.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that we have the answer, because it's, no one does I know. We try to use it to teach them some time management. We try to put it down on paper so they can see it and write it down, you know, the amount of time they use a phone or the amount of time they're, the things that, you know, kind of break down their day and where their week even, and where their time's going. and just sit down with them individually and try to say, look, the amount of time you're in study hall, if you're on your phone there, you're on your phone here, or there, like it just adds up, and you're best at what you do all the time. And if you're on your phone all the time, that's what you're best at. If you're in the gym shooting, that's what you're best at. Like wherever you put your time is what you're going to be good at. So we try to break it down like that. We don't want to take it from them. Listen, this is the world they live in.
Right.
We want them to promote our program. We want them to promote themselves now with name, image, likeness. We want them to use it to their advantage, but not to the point where it's detrimental to the program, which is, it's a hard thing to do. And some guys are really good at it and some guys aren't. And yeah. It's just something we have to battle all the time. Maybe a losing battle, and maybe we're just above a generation that I don't know. The couple younger guys we have on our staff are probably better suited to talk to them about it.
Right.
You know, yeah. They just understand it more.
For sure. Yeah. I know there's things that I'm always on. My daughter, who's had her phone, I don't know, for whatever, 2-3 years, she's always, there'll be things that I'll do. She'd be like, Dad, like you moron, what are you doing? You know, like, what are you doing? You don't know how to do that? I'm like, I don't know. I go, I can get to it through this. She's like, no, just do it this way. I'm like, okay. So yeah, there's definitely a generation gap there. I feel like I'm pretty functional technology wise, but there's some things that you watch a kid do and they just do it so intuitively. And we just don't have that same capability of being able to figure that out.
You know, and even outside of the phone, you know, just yesterday made me think about, we were in the gym with our guys and there was probably 5 or 6 of them in there shooting, and they're on the gun, you know, shooting, it's passed it to them. They're doing these drills and moving around and they're getting up 200 shots in like no time. Right. And I say to one of them, I said, man, I wish they had this when I played. And he looked at me like I had 4 heads. And he was like, what do you mean they didn't have this when you played? I said, the gun? Like, they didn't have the gun when I played. We had to have somebody rebound for us, or we had to chase our own ball. And, I mean, just the fact that he couldn't like fathom that idea, that he couldn't come into the gym and shoot without the gun. I was like, yeah, I just never had it.
Right.
He just couldn't understand that. So even the pressure, like that's just another piece of technology in the way the game's changed and life has changed, that we put pressure on them to come in the gym and shoot because it's so easy.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, I don't remember having that pressure put on me because the coach couldn't say, hey man, we got a gun. You can come in here and get 200 shots up in 30 minutes. Like they couldn't say that to me. Where nowadays we do. I mean, I'm guilty of it, telling a guy he needs to get in the gym and get some shots up because it's easy. That's the world we live in.
Yeah. What's funny too is, and I didn't think about it in these terms, but it makes sense. Like I'll work with kids who are 5th, 6th, 7th grade, and you'll say, flip the ball out to yourself and mm-hmm. catch the ball and shoot it. And they don't know how to do that. Like they can't accurately flip the ball out, go get it and take a shot, because they never have to do that. Because if they really are a kid that's getting up shots, chances are they have access to a facility, whether it's through their high school or maybe a private facility, and they got a shooter. Or a lot of times too, now you have a parent that's going to be there, that's going to rebound for them. Dad wants them to be successful, and so dad's there rebounding. It's just, it's a totally different era than before when we didn't have all the tech. And we've been through this a million times on the podcast, but there's just, again, there's good things about it. And there's negative things about it. And I think you have to, as a coach, as a player, you have to just continue to evolve and kind of meet the game where it is as it continues to progress and try to take advantage of the things that are positive and try to minimize maybe the negatives that come along with it. Speaking of which, where are you guys at in terms of NIL? How has that gone? Has it been what you expected? Has there been surprises? Just maybe give us a little description about how that's gone for you guys as a coaching staff, handling that and helping your guys to navigate it.
Well, they kind of limit what you can do with coaches. So we've had to see what the school allowed, our licensing, with our logos and that kind of thing, what they're allowed to do. So we've really just tried to educate our players. We've had multiple meetings with our compliance coordinator and other people in our athletic department just to give them an idea what they can do, how they should attack it, how much time they should put into it. But the main thing they got to do is report everything back to us, so we make sure they're not taking advantage of or doing something and not getting the right compensation. So we've had, I mean, over half our team is making money off one way or another, whether it's with local businesses or stuff they've started on their own. COVID hampered a little bit of it because I think some of them want to do camps back home, which is going to be a big thing for them.
Absolutely.
Eventually they'll get to it. So obviously big schools, big markets have a much bigger opportunity to make money, but I think our guys have done a pretty good job of putting themselves out there within the rules, and good for them. We've told them this is a great thing and we want them to make as much money as they can without putting a hamper on their academic or their basketball success. Cause without their success academically and with basketball, they're not going to make any money
for sure.
So they got to make sure those things stay first, and then really go out there and attack it. And some of the guys are really good at it and put some time into it and they've benefited, and other guys don't think it's worth it. You know, even some of our better players say, yeah, it's not really worth it to me. I'd rather spend my time doing other stuff, which is fine too. But what we want them to know is we support them and that we think it's a really, really good thing for college athletics. One way or the other, whichever way they choose.
Anything that was surprising about it that maybe you guys didn't anticipate as you sort of stepped into these uncharted waters?
Yeah, the licensing thing was a little surprise for us because we noticed some other schools, kids were using their logos and their name with a logo of their school selling things. And we were immediately told here at High Point we couldn't do that because of our licensing agreement, who does our logo. So that was a little bit of surprise because to me that doesn't make it an even playing field for athletes.
Right.
And that can affect, eventually if it could affect a kid picking a school over another school. And I don't like that part of it. If we're going to do it, I think it should be the only thing that shouldn't be a level playing field is the market of the school like we have now. Power fives are obviously more marketable than the lower divisions. That's the only thing that really surprised me because we thought that no one could use their school because it was supposed to be the kid's name, image, and likeness. But some schools are allowing them to use the logo, which to me makes it the school's name, image, and likeness as well.
For sure.
I wish the NCAA could find a way to get with the licensing agreements and make it equal one way or the other. I don't really care which way they go. I just want it to be even.
Yeah, it seems like that would be something that eventually, hopefully, they can get ironed out because, like you said, if you can associate yourself with that university, it's just one more piece of branding that could be valuable for whatever company is looking to pay the athlete to do whatever it is that they're looking to do. Or if the athlete's just trying to market themselves, whether it's just doing a camp and you can not only attach your own name to it, but also attach your university name to it, then I would say there'd certainly be value in that without question. So yeah, it would seem like eventually they'd want to get that to be an even playing field. All right, let's work backwards. Let's go back to you as a college student. You talked a little bit about how when you went to school, you were just like, I just want to play basketball, and the academic piece of it, which clearly now is really important to you. But that time, just like most kids, the reason why you choose a school is you're trying to find the right basketball fit, the right coaching staff, that kind of thing. So once you get there, is your thought always that you wanted to go into coaching, that's why you go into elementary education? Or just what was your thought process as you got to school and then kind of as you evolved as a student and as an athlete over the course of those 4 years?
Yeah, there was never a question that I wanted to be a teacher and coach basketball. My dad had kind of told me he wished he would have done that because he coached high school basketball without a college degree. And he was lucky enough in Ohio, you could do that. And he had a job that was flexible that allowed him to do that. But he kind of instilled in me that, hey, if you want to coach, you need to be a teacher. So I had no question. I wanted to be an elementary teacher for the simple fact that I didn't want to teach my players. I didn't want to have them in the classroom. I wanted to be there at the school or close to it, but I didn't want to have to teach them. I thought that was too much. So I went into the elementary side, which I loved that at the time, and teaching young kids. So I never changed. I stuck with elementary ed and knew I wanted to coach high school basketball forever. That was what I was going to do, right? Like I had it figured out at 18 years old what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, and quickly learned that was not the case. But I did go through it, and I taught elementary school for 4 years and right out of college, and started coaching high school as my dad's assistant for 2 years, and then became a head coach for 2 years. So I thought I was on the path.
All right. Well, let's talk about each of those experiences separately. Let's start out maybe with the teaching part of it. Mm-hmm. What did you like about your teaching job? What did you dislike about it? And just tell us a little bit about those experiences, because obviously we have a lot of coaches out there or coaching high school that are teaching at all different levels. So just tell us a little bit about your experience as a teacher.
Yeah, so I taught third grade regular education my first 2 years at the elementary school I went to for the elementary principal that was my principal.
Nice, there you go.
So that was a little unique. The school had just opened a brand new K-12 school, Alexander, and down in Albany, Ohio, outside of Athens. My dad was the varsity coach now. He wasn't, you know, uniquely enough, I talk about my dad, but he was never my head coach, junior high, junior varsity, varsity. He was on the bench for every game as an assistant, but he was never the head coach. He took over as head coach after I graduated high school. He became the head coach a couple years later. So when I came back, he's the head coach and needed an assistant. And his assistant, I think, knew that I wanted to coach. So he kind of stepped aside, thought it was the right time, let me become the assistant for my dad, which is 2 years I'll always cherish and learned more. You can't replace that experience. You get to coach with your dad, the sport that you grew up with him teaching you everything you know about life, got you a college degree, the best 4 years of your life getting to play college basketball, which was your dream. And now you get to come back and do it with him. I mean, it doesn't get much better. At your alma mater. So I couldn't like make that up. I couldn't write the book any better, right? Like I got to come back. So then my second year with my first year, he teaches me a lot and lets me have some reins to things that I probably shouldn't at 21 years old. And then the second year, he really let me kind of take a lot over. And he was still the head coach by all means, but he gave me a big voice and we were really good. A not very talented team and set some school records and won the first conference championship there in years and did all these things. So of course at 23 now, I think I can rule the world and I know everything there is to know about basketball, right? So there's 40 job openings for head coaches in the state of Ohio that year. And I applied for every single one. And I got two interviews. And my dad came back and said, I'll just step aside and be your assistant and you take over. And I'd always said, and I still stick to this, that at least for now, I don't want to be the head coach where I played. I loved being the assistant, but it was hard. I was coaching the kids of my former coaches. I was teaching kids of people that I had known for a long time, because where I went to school was a very small community and everybody knows everybody. And I got some comments and some phone calls that I didn't take very well at 21, 22 years old, that about my dad being the head coach and about me getting special treatment and, you know, all the bad stories. There was so much good, but those bad ones stick with you and it's your community.
Right, for sure.
So I needed to step away. I needed to get away from there and do my own thing and kind of make my own path away from my dad. And so I explained that to him and I got two interviews. I ended up getting one of the jobs, which was at Fort Loramie High School, small Division IV school, north of Dayton, which was maybe the best job of the 40 that I applied for, to be honest with you. And I couldn't believe that Mr. Ludlow, the superintendent there, gave me the opportunity at 23. And the story I always tell about that is I interviewed once. It went great. They had a special education job open, so I was going to have to go back to school a little bit to get that certification, which I did while I was teaching there. But in my second interview, I go in, the last part of it, there's like eight people sitting in a room. It's the AD, it's the principals, it's the superintendent, it's friends of the basketball team, which I don't even know what that means, but they're
that big 8-person panel is never fun. That is never a fun situation.
Exactly. I mean, this is a school that graduates 30 kids a year, and there's 8 people here in this interview, and they just start firing questions. And one of the last ones was, why should we hire you? You know, and me being 23 and completely arrogant thought, and my answer was somewhere along these lines of, because you won't find anybody better. Like that was literally my, as soon as I said it, I was like, you are an idiot. Like, what are you thinking? Cause that's not me by any means. Like, and I walked out, my wife was in the car cause she was on the second interview with me cause we went to dinner and did the whole community thing. And she just had to wait for that last part. And when I went, I sat down in the car and she's, how'd it go? And I said, well, we were engaged at the time. I said, well, we're not moving because I just lost the job. and the next day he called and offered me the job. I don't know why he got through that bad answer. But so I went there and taught special ed and coached. And I think to answer one of your original questions about how, you know, the teaching and coaching high school, what I love about high school that you don't get to me at the college level, and I've been at all of them, the intimacy with the kids of how close you are with them. I think you get closer to kids at the high school level than you do at the college level because this becomes such a business. It's the part I don't like. And I think a lot of people overlook that as far as college basketball goes. You think you get more time with the players and your relationships are closer, which they probably are because you're getting that 18 to 22 year old time in people's lives where we're all really molded, right? But those high school relationships with those kids, I'm still close with the guys I coached at Fort Laramie. I mean, I talked to one yesterday. It's not, I love those guys, man. And they made me a so much better of a coach because they challenged me, but they listened to me as a 23-year-old kid. They trusted me for whatever reason and bought into what I was trying to do. And I loved those 2 years. The teaching part was what eventually made me want to kind of move on because I felt really squeezed in. I put so much time into coaching. I was afraid I was lacking as a teacher, which was not fair to the third grade kids that I had. And I didn't like that feeling. It was a feeling of just being torn in two directions that you love both of them, but one of them had to give, right? And I couldn't give up my time with my team to put more into teaching, which was the right answer. I should have definitely stepped away from basketball a little bit and taught more. So the answer for me was to move on. As hard as it was, because my team was really, really good, and I thought we had a chance to win a state championship the next 2 years. But selfishly, I had to move on, if that makes sense.
No, it makes total sense. I think that there's a lot of people that I think have been in that position when they're trying to make a decision between which direction do they go. And clearly, if you're going to be a high school coach and a teacher, a good portion of your day is going to be spent on non-basketball related activities. That's not to say that as a college assistant coach that you are not performing non-basketball activities, as I'm sure you well know, but you are you are basketball, at least it is tangentially related to the basketball program that you are currently working for, as opposed to when you're teaching. And clearly, if you're teaching third grade social studies, that is not in any way, shape, or form related to what you're doing with your basketball team. So I completely understand that. I think that that's something that a lot of people wrestle with, making that decision, whether they make it initially right out of the gate, coming out of college and deciding, hey, do I want to pursue, a graduate assistant position, or I want to try to be a video coordinator, whatever it is, mm-hmm. to get my start, or do I want to go and try to coach at the high school level? And so you see guys that, you know, again, I think you find the niche that makes the most sense for you. And it sounds like you've been able to do that. And when you think back on your first experience with your dad and then getting that initial head coaching position, what's something that when you think about the influence that your dad has had on you as a coach, what's something that's a part of your coaching personality or style that you feel like you, whether it's subconsciously or consciously, that you took from or that you learned from your dad during the time that you watched him growing up and then during your time that you worked directly with him as an assistant?
Well, the first thing I knew, and really this was watching him, you know, when I was a varsity player in high school, I think is when it clicked with me. Because it's like I said, he wasn't the head coach on the varsity team, but he was on the bench because he was the head coach of the JV team. So I got to watch him, and and even to this day, he got out of it for a few years and now he's back into it at a different school. And to this day, whether they're good or bad, doesn't matter. His kids always seem to love to play for him. And I've said this previously in an interview that my dad was ahead of his time. He's 61 now and been coaching forever, but he was ahead of his time in the sense that he was the guy that kids always wanted to play for. And it didn't matter really what their minutes were. Like, it used to be, you know, old school coach. When you think of an old school coach, you think of a coach that says, you do as I say, not as I do. And you're going to listen. And if I say jump, you say how high, you know, the whole just commands, you know, I don't ask anything. I tell you what to do. He was so ahead of that. And kids just kind of gravitated toward playing hard for him because they love to play for him. So I got to see that as a varsity player while I was coaching JV. And at that point, I knew I was going to be a coach. So I was really evaluating my coach, him, and other coaches, college coach. I was really like into the coaching deal at this point. What I didn't realize was the reason they loved to play for him so much. I saw this after he became the varsity head coach, and I got to see him do it a couple years before, and even as his assistant. It's because of the stuff he did outside of practice and outside of games. The money he raised, the camps he took him to, the meals he had at our house that my mom would cook, the things he did in the community that they saw that helped their basketball. They knew that he loved coaching them. There was no question in a kid's mind. And so when he got them on the court or in practice, they would do anything to play for him. And kids played for him that didn't even play basketball. They'd come out for the team. And he's doing it again where he's at now. You know, he does stuff off the court that makes them know how much he loves coaching them and being their coach, which is why that part of him being a coach outweighs any of the X's and O's and all that. So I've tried to mimic that. I've tried to keep that in the back of my mind. Definitely as a head coach at the high school level, it was very, very important. It gets harder at this level because, like I said, it becomes such a business that you got to kind of take a step back every once in a while and remind yourself. But that I took that from him more than anything. I took that from him.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I think that it's certainly an underrated piece, especially when you talk about the high school level, getting involved in the community and letting kids know that you're there for them mm-hmm. off the floor, whether that's – I think – sometimes teachers, especially if you're a teacher in the building where you coach, I think that's a huge advantage when you can mm-hmm. see those kids and get touches on them every single day when you're seeing them in the hallway and it's just easier to communicate. But nonetheless, I think that there are lots of different ways that you mentioned that your dad, things that he did and things that other coaches do outside of what happens on the practice floor, what happens on Tuesday and Friday night. Those are the things that really have an impact and let kids know that you care about them. And as we all know in the coaching profession, if kids know that you care about them and they know you're coming from a place where you have their best interest at heart, then you end up with a situation where those kids are going to run through a brick wall for you. And it sounds like that's what your dad was able to do. And sounds like that's what you try to do when you're going through and doing the things that you do on a daily basis. Tell me a little bit about the transition from high school coaching then to college coaching. So you make the decision, you know, teaching is something that maybe is taken away from the amount of time that I want to spend in basketball. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like I can give it my full effort. So where do you go? Who do you turn to? What's the first call you make when you decide that you want to try to transition and go to college?
Well, again, I'm at this point, I'm 25 or something like that. And I don't know anything about college coaching. My college coach was fired shortly after I was done, and I couldn't get a hold of him, so I didn't have much help there. Luckily, my assistant took over, Coach Crutchfield, who everybody knows now, who was at West Liberty and did so many great things, is now at Nova. I was able to call him. He helped me get the Fort Laramie job, actually, and then I was able to talk to him some. My high school coach that I was so close to, Coach Reese, had an illness and had to get out of coaching at the time, so he was kind of out of the game and needed to focus on his health. And my dad was just a high school coach. I mean, he didn't have college ties. So I really didn't know what to do. I'm only, searching every job I can find and applying and getting no luck. I don't even get a phone call. Don't get emails back. I wish I would have kept track of how many. Because I applied for every men's, women's, Division I, II, III NAIA job you could possibly find without one phone call ever. But I kept doing it. I kept doing it. And to kind of rewind a little bit, after I decided I thought college was the thing, which was the hardest decision I've made in my coaching career. And it's not close because I hated leaving those high school kids that I still love today. But my wife, we got married. Why was that Fort Laramie? She kind of said, you know, we're young and able to do this. And if you want to do it, let's do it now. And she kind of pushed me a little bit to take the leap. So I finally get a phone call back, from a guy at Methodist University who was the assistant there. It's a Division III school here in Fayetteville, North Carolina. He called me back and said, hey, we'd love to bring you down for an interview. We got an assistant job open. And we talk, we do a phone interview. And at the end of the phone interview, he says, before you drive down here to do the in-person interview, there's something I got to tell you. And I said, okay. And he said, this job pays $0.
I knew that was coming, Eric. I could sense that one. I didn't know if it was going to be zero or it was going to be like $500, but I knew it was going to be something.
So I said, okay. I said, yeah, I'll do it. And I got off the phone. I told my wife, I said, hey, I'm going to go to this interview. I can't take this job, but I'm going to go just for the experience because I need to have a college interview like experience. So she said, okay. So we jump in the car. We drive halfway one night, stop, drive the rest of the way the next day, do the interview. Goes great. We get back in the car and I basically, we both look at each other kind of like, let's do it. You know, it was a good situation. It's the only call I was going to get back. Now that I had been fighting to try to get something, and I thought this is just what I got to do. And you know what? We're young. We don't have kids. We still don't. But at the time, we didn't know if we wanted to have kids. So we were like, if we're going to do it, we got to do it. We got a little bit in the savings account. Let's just sell everything we own and go. And that's exactly what we did. We sold everything. We had one little truck full of some stuff. Don't tell anybody, but we lied to an apartment complex and we got them to, you know, we fibbed a little bit on the employment and, they let us in. And so we lived in an apartment with no furniture, in just south of Raleigh. And I drove an hour one way every day, to Methodist for $0 and, made it work. And it was awesome. I mean, I was coaching college basketball and had never dreamed I'd be there. At a D3 school and Coach Smith there, David Smith, I'll forever be grateful for. So that's really how it went down. And we literally lived in this apartment with no furniture and sat on the floor for the first year and a half of our marriage.
and you're still married. So you did something right. You did something right along the way there.
Well, there was nowhere to go but up.
There you go.
Like I set the standard really, really low and it's worked in my benefit.
There you go. Now you're looking like a star, right?
Yeah, right. It was great.
I like it. I like it. So what, you know, obviously you say, I love it. What was it specifically? Was it just the fact that you could focus on the basketball and that teaching piece had been taken out of it? Was just what about it made you immediately feel like, hey, this was the right move for me?
It's kind of what you said earlier, that everything I did in a day was connected to the basketball program. Every time I worked with a kid academically, every time I made a phone call, it was all to do with the basketball program. And I didn't feel like I had to slight anything else in my day to do that, which was so fulfilling. It was hard, but it was really, really fulfilling for me and how I wanted to spend my time. And I still got to work with young guys, which was, you know, also important to me. I mean, it's why I started coaching basketball. I always say that we all coach because we love the sport first. If anybody says that's not first, then I don't know what they're doing. Because yes, we all want to help young people, but you have to love the sport too.
Yep.
So I love the sport more than anything. And then I love helping young people succeed or kind of develop, whether it was through high school or college. But I was getting to do that all day, which was awesome. And then the traveling with the team all the time and the amount of time you got to be with the team was fun for me. And at the Division III level, it's not that far removed from the high school level because of the way the rules are set up. So there was still that intimacy with the players that kind of, to me, the higher the level you go, goes away a little bit. It's just kind of the way it's built, which I've said publicly before that's one of the things I don't like about the Division I level. That you got to really create that. And the higher I've gone, that's one thing I miss about high school, Division III, Division II, is some of that.
So, This is a kind of a skip ahead question, but it also, I think, relates to your experiences at the lower levels. How do you look at the off-season work and the off-season access that you have to your players at the Division I level versus obviously you're at the Division III level and you have no access to your players. And it seems like, and I'm just speaking for myself, I haven't coached at the Division I level, haven't really been around it on a day-to-day basis since I was a player. Mm-hmm. But I know when I was playing and our season ended, like I got handed like a 3-page ditto of like, here's your summer workouts. You know, we'll see you back here and we'll see you back here next August. And then I went and worked on my game and worked on my body and did all those kinds of things, which obviously you guys now, players are on campus, 48 weeks out of the year.
Right.
And you've got the access to off-season workouts and all those things, which obviously can play tremendous benefit to helping your players to develop. And yet I know, speaking for myself as a player at least, that I needed some time to hear a different voice and mm-hmm. to be separated for the coaching staff from the coaching staff to be able to recharge. And I know we've talked to a couple of Division I head coaches that have said that they sort of defer those summer workouts to their staff for that very reason, that, man, these guys hear me all season and now they got to hear me all summer. And then conversely, at the Division III level where you have no access, I think most of the Division III coaches that we've talked to would like to have at least the ability to have some access to their players. So I'm just curious kind of what your thoughts are in terms of what's the pluses and minuses of sort of the way the Division I system is set up for the off season right now in your mind?
Yeah. So you're right. You do have them nearly year round now, especially with the 8 weeks in the off season of summer work. And then if you do a foreign tour like we did this year, that's another 15 days with them. So it's really year round. Especially every fourth year when you do that foreign tour. The positive is you have an influence on the guys year round for your program. You know, you know where they're at, you know what they're eating, you know when they're working out, you know what they're focused on. The downside is exactly what you said. It's almost too much all the time and they need a break. And I do think Division I's kind of it's at a crossroads right now where we're trying to figure out the balance, because I think there's some pull to go back, to pull it back a little bit, because it might be too much. Listen, we've all been 18 to 20 years old and 22 years old. We need a break. Like it's between academics and basketball on top of all the pressure we talked about earlier on coming at you, like let these kids get away and be kids sometimes. You know, because even as a Division II player, and I had my whole summer, I felt like when I graduated college that I wasn't a real college student. Like I never got to experience that just kind of like being a college student or being in that transition of life between my career and high school, which not everybody gets, but I had that opportunity and I felt like I blinked and it was over. So I do think that these kids need it, and we all recharge and come back better when we take a step back when we need it. We're not necessarily giving these kids the opportunity to do that, I don't think, at the full level we should be. So there are positives and negatives. I don't know the answer. I'm not a scientist, or I don't know what's best. And every kid is different for that matter. Some kids want to be here and that's fine. As long as they have the opportunity. Some kids don't need to be here and they might be better for them.
Yeah, it's a challenge. And I think it's hard as a coach to advocate for, hey, we want less contact with our players, because obviously everybody wants to have the opportunity to help their team improve. And as you said, to be able to have an influence. And that's really what it's all about, is using the game of basketball to have an influence on somebody's life and help them to improve. And obviously you want to win some games and be successful along the way. But it's just, I look at it and it feels like that there's probably a happy medium somewhere in between that it could eventually settle. But as we know, where NCAA Division I basketball is right now at this moment, I mean, I think there's so many different things that have to be figured out. We talked already about NIL. You've got the transfer portal. You've got the offseason. Yeah. You have the whole thing where who knows what even the NCAA looks like in 5 or 10 years. Mm-hmm. Could be totally different. Then you have the Power Five conferences versus the lower levels of Division I. And it's just, I think there's a lot of things that over the next 5 to 10 years, the landscape is going to continue to evolve and change. You got the NBA with the G League and guys going overseas, and whether or not they're going to rescind the one and done. And there's just so many things that are going on that I think college basketball is going to look really, really different at some point going forward. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes. Let's go back to you at Methodist. Mm-hmm. After you get done there for a year, making your huge contract, your huge salary, you probably look around and say, well, I don't know if I can match this salary somewhere else, but I'm sure you were anxious to maybe at least earn a dollar. So how do you end up getting the opportunity at Mount Olive?
Yeah. So at the end of the season at Methodist, like you said, Division III, you can't do much in the off season. So I got my substitute license and started substitute teaching down here in North Carolina, but I also was still recruiting every chance I could. So I would go recruit, you know, as many Division III, you can kind of go wherever you want, whenever you want. So I was doing that. In the meantime, my wife got a job at St. Mary's School, which is an all-girls boarding school in Raleigh. And they offered us a place to live on campus for free. So that saved our life. We were able to move out of the apartment, move into free housing, which was part of her job, part of her contract. I had to drive a little bit further, but that was fine because it was free. And I'm recruiting, and I sit down beside a guy named Joey Higginbotham, who's the head coach at Mount Olive, still is. And we start talking, and I tell him about being a Division II player. And he says, well, I'm adding a second assistant, and would you be interested? And Mount Olive was a little bit about the same amount of drive, really. It's about an hour and 10 minutes from where we lived in Raleigh. And I said, yeah. I said, I'd love to coach Division II because that's what I know. That's kind of what that was kind of my goal because I love Division II. And he said, well, I think I got $5,000. And I said, I'll take it. I didn't even really care what I had to do. Like, I'll take
that's a 5,000% raise right there.
That's exactly right. So I went down and interviewed with him shortly after that. It went really well. And I interviewed the day I interviewed, I was going to be a second assistant to Ahmad Dorsett, who was the top assistant there. So I got to know him for a day, which will become important as we go through this story of me coaching. So Joey offered me the job, and I was there for 3 years. Ahmad didn't end up being there my first year. He took a job at Bowie State. We ended up hiring a guy named Akeem Miskdeen, who is now an assistant at Florida. And we shared an office. Our chairs touched back to back. And we had an absolute blast coaching that year. We were top 20 in the country, went to the NCAA tournament. Had a couple All-Americans, just had a blast with Joey and stayed there for 3 years and had a lot of success and learned how to run. Joey runs some of the best practices in the country. If anybody's ever driving through North Carolina and you want to get some pickles, go down to Mount Olive, get some pickles, and go watch Joey Higginbotham's team practice. And you'll enjoy every second of it.
What makes a practice so good?
He is the way he organizes it, the beginning of his practices, he has bang drills that the guys got to complete every day. And if they don't meet the goals, you don't move on. So you may not get through the bang drills. And that just means the guys weren't ready to practice that day. And we just do them for 2 hours and then we leave. Once they do get them, we move on. And everything is so efficient, from the water breaks. You get a teammate's water bottle and hand it to him, which I think is incredible, down to the what he demands and the way he gets guys from day one. You know, we all say we like guys to run from drill to drill, and then you go to a practice and nobody does it. Those guys do it. The intensity there is in the drills, but still fun. Like, sometimes we confuse intensity for not fun. He just somehow encapsulates all of that, which is really fun to be a part of and was fun to learn. And I hope I can run a practice like that someday.
It's kind of amazing. I think just the different practices that I've been to over the years and different coaches that I've worked with, there does seem to be, I don't know if it's a knack or it's just a skill that some coaches seem to be able to come upon naturally, that they can get guys to compete and play hard, and yet at the same time also keep that fun aspect to it. And the guys that do it well, it seems really seamless. It seems like, they just somehow that just miraculously happens. And we all know that that's not why it happens, but some guys just really do seem to have a knack for it. And I think it's really fun when you get an opportunity to see those kinds of practices being run by a coach who gets their players to play hard, but also you can tell that the players enjoy being at practice. And that's a difficult line to walk, as you well know.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And he's the best at it, and he's still there doing it. And we had a chance to play him this year. He was the first game ever in our new arena here at High Point, which was really awesome for me to get to bring him back here and talk to his team and kind of where I felt like, I know I started at Methodist, but Joey really gave me the break. And I learned a ton from him. And so during my 3 years there, to kind of move on, is he promoted me each year. He gave me a little bit more money, and he only had two assistants. And I think by my third year, and I was teaching volleyball and strength training on the side at Mount Olive, I think I made $17,000 and thought I was super rich.
Absolutely. You started zero, and everything looks pretty good, right?
That is exactly right. That's exactly right.
All right. So how do you get to Shepherd?
So Joey and I, we talked every year about what my next step was, and he had applied for some jobs that he thought he may get and just didn't. Obviously I wanted to be the head coach at Mount Olive, and wasn't happening, but I still didn't have health insurance. And my wife needed health insurance, and we were just getting a little, obviously us probably 30 years old now at that point, 31 maybe. And so I applied for some jobs, and Shepherd, being in Mount Olive's conference, I didn't know the coach there, had never met him. But he saw West Liberty on my resume and brought me up for an interview and offered me the job right away. And Justin Namlich is as good a coach out there as there is in Division II. Cause we all know, or if you don't, Division II is not fair. Every job is so unique, and the amount of scholarships you get and the budgets and how you have to recruit or not recruit. And Justin does more with less than anybody I was ever around as far as a recruiter, and the way he prepares for games and practices is second to none. I mean, he is prepared for absolutely everything. You're going to throw a junk defense at him, I promise you they've practiced it. Like, it's not, he has an answer for everything. Which is probably why he went to Columbia and graduated from there. So it was awesome to learn from him for a year. I'm glad he gave me the opportunity, and I got to take a full-time job with benefits and thought I was like a real adult at the time. But fast forward, and we were only there for about 10 months because the name Ahmad Dorsett that I mentioned earlier that was at Mount Olive, this is 4 years after I met him. He is now an assistant at High Point University. And they are creating a director of video operations job. And he called me. And I think he three-way called me with Joey. And Joey Higginbotham and him are on the phone. We're talking. And he said, hey, if you want to get in Division I, here's your chance. What do you think? And I said, yeah, I wanted to jump at it. And then once I came and did the interview at High Point and got to see the campus and the way the program was going with Coach Cherry, it was a no-brainer. I had to do it. I knew nothing about the video side of stuff. Zero. But Coach Cherry wanted a basketball coach that would learn it versus a video guy that might not have been as much of a basketball guy. So I got really lucky that he gave me the opportunity. And that was 9 years ago. And here I am.
What did the learning curve look like to be in the video room?
The good thing was they had no video guy before me. So anything I did was a plus. It was all new video system, all new equipment, all new software, and I basically got to do it the way I wanted. The problem was Coach Cherry waited to officially hire me till the first week of school. So like they're already here. The guys are here. They're going in workouts, and I had nothing. I didn't have a laptop. I didn't have a camera. I didn't have anything. So there was a solid month in there where I really had to like grind and call every person I knew in the video world or get contacts and try to figure it out. And I did. And with the help from a lot of people at High Point and a lot of coaches around the country that didn't know me from anything. But it worked out. And Coach Cherry and I formed a great relationship. And my second year, he bumped me up to Director of Player Development, which still was mostly all video stuff, but I got a little bit more of a responsibility. And then after that, an assistant job opened up, and lucky for me, I'd proven myself. And he walked into my office, and it's a day you'll never forget. And he said, "All right, you ready to be an assistant, right?" And I, absolutely. And that was it. It was June 20th. I'll never forget it. And he offered me an assistant job. So I became his assistant for 3 years, and then was lucky enough to stay on with Coach Smith when Coach Cherry was let go, you know, which is a whole nother deal about being at the Division I level and getting fired, and you got to figure out what you're going to do next. So I was lucky enough to be here with Tubby Smith, which is surreal to me to this day.
So what does that look like when your previous staff that you're a part of gets let go, and now you have to figure it out? And it's not, obviously it happens sometimes that some guys end up staying and a lot of times guys end up leaving. So what did that look like for you in order for you to be able to stay? What was the interview like? Did you interview directly with Coach Smith? How did that work?
Yeah, it was unique, I think, in the way it works a lot of times. But so Coach Cherry was let go. It was a Wednesday of spring break. I got a phone call at 11 o'clock in the morning. We had the day, Coach gave us the day off. I was sitting on the couch with my wife, and I got a phone call from one of the other assistants, and he said, I just left the AD's office. We're getting fired. And couldn't really believe it. This was all a shock to everybody. We didn't have any idea that was a chance that could happen. So I drove into the AD's office because I got a phone call from his secretary. And by the time I got there, he had met with the rest of the staff already, and I was by myself. And he had kind of asked me this was in March. He said, your contract goes through May. You don't have to come in. This is up to you. But if you would come in and, you know, kind of help the guys work out, keep them on track academically, you know, we'd really appreciate that because your contract goes through May. Well, I didn't have anything to do besides look for another job. So I took a few days, kind of gathered my thoughts, gathered my resume, and got everything ready because I needed to look for another job, started making phone calls. But I also knew I wanted to help the guys that were here because it wasn't fair to them. And so I started coming into work every day. The director of operations and myself, we kept coming around. Everyone else kind of packed their stuff and moved on to try to get another job, which was neither way was right or wrong. You just had to choose which one you wanted and go for it. So kept coming to work. Coach Smith gets hired a few weeks later. Luckily, I'd met him a few times before that because, funny enough, my first game I ever coached as a Division I assistant was against Coach Smith when he was at Texas Tech. And then we got to know each other because he's a High Point alum and he would come back every once in a while. I was here for his Hall of Fame induction. So he vaguely knew me. So I kept coming to work. I got here before him every day. I left after him and made sure of that he saw me in my office and I answered any question he might have had about High Point or the job, recruiting, whatever it was. I was going to make sure I had the answer. I had a booklet I presented to him about the job and why I wanted to be on his staff. He never asked me for it. It was just, I told him, hey, I want to stay on staff, whether it's as assistant, video guy, whatever it is. I'd love a chance to work for you. So fast forward to the April recruiting period. He comes in my office the first weekend and says, hey, Eric, I don't think I'm going to have a job for you. Because he obviously had people he needed to help in the coaching profession.
For sure.
He's been coaching forever. He's got so many guys that, and I understood. I had no hard feelings about it. He said, but what I'm going to do is I want you to go recruit as a High Point assistant. And hopefully you can meet some other coaches while you're out and about and, you know, find another job, and let me know if I can call somebody. So he said, go wherever you want. You just pick a tournament and go. So I went to Pittsburgh for a tournament. He ended up flying up for a few hours, spent some time with me. The next weekend he comes in my office. Hey, I'm not going to have a job for you. Let's do the same thing this weekend. So I pick Atlanta. I go down to Atlanta. He flies down, spends a day with me, flies back, watching recruits for High Point. Like, we were actually recruiting and I was trying to find another job. So come back, the month of May kind of flies by while he's doing, you know, he's a new head coach at his alma mater. He's got a million things going on. I'm coming in every day before him, leaving after, like I said. Got to know his son, Gigi, who's our associate head coach, really well. And it was about May, I think it was May 27th. I think it was a Tuesday. He walked in my office and, or actually I was leaving. I finally got to the point, this is good or bad, I don't know. Got to the point where I was like, I can't stay here. It's like 8 o'clock at night. My wife's at home. I'm 3 days from losing my contract and my everything. And I said, I got to go home. I'm not going to get the job. And as I'm walking by, I had to walk by his office every night. If I walked out or went to the restroom or anything, I had to walk by his office. So he always saw me. But this day I had my backpack because I was leaving, which I never did. And he saw me and he said, hey, come in here. And we had a great relationship. We talked every day, kind of like I was on staff, but he had been consistent and completely transparent about the fact that he didn't have a job for me. And at this point, he's hired some other people, but not an assistant. And he says, "Hey, I'm going to keep you on as assistant." Just rips the Band-Aid off. Doesn't even, there's no like talk like, "Hey, you're going to be an assistant here." I mean, if he could have saw what was going on inside my body at that point, he'd have probably been like, "This guy's nuts." Because I was like, I was crying, I was screaming, I was jumping up and down, but I just had to keep like this stoic face of like, "Thank you, sir." And just, yeah, you know, right, like try to right. walk out. Which was just a wild feeling. My wife was working that night, and I immediately drove to her job and was like telling her, and we celebrated and had a great time and was so fortunate that he gave me that chance. So it was a little bit unique. It wasn't really an interview, but he was interviewing me when he came to spend time with me on the road. So I try to tell coaches that all the time. You just never know, man. Somebody's watching you. Somebody's watching you or looking at you. And he was making phone calls about me that I didn't know. So very fortunate, and can't believe I'm Tubby Smith's assistant and got to spend last week at Kentucky retiring his jersey when we played against him in Rupp Arena. It's amazing.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. So you had a 6-week, one-man sort of stealth interview as opposed to the 8-person committee that you had to sit in front of when you're interviewing for a high school job, right? It was sort of a much different process, but fortunately for you, it ended up in both cases that whatever you did, you were able to sell yourself in the right way. So I think certainly there's a good lesson out there for anybody who's coaching. I think just hearing your story, you think about being willing to start and pack up and move and go somewhere and make $0. I think that that's something that for young coaches that want to get into college coaching, there's so many guys that have a similar story to what you went through in terms of you got to start at the bottom. You got to be willing to go where the jobs are. You got to be willing to work for little or nothing. And then you work your way up, you work hard, you stay late, you come early, you do the things that the coaches that you're working for need you to do, you be there to serve them. And then if you do that, you do it well, then you get some opportunities, you build some relationships, and eventually you get yourself into a position where you're going to end up getting a good opportunity like you've been able to get there at High Point and take advantage of that, and then just continue to build your career and look for, you know, where you're going to go next and what's going to happen as you move forward. And certainly, I'm sure sitting there where you are today and you look back at your no furniture apartment, that first job at Methodist, and it probably seems not that long away, depending on how you look at it. It probably seems like it was yesterday, and then in a lot of ways, it probably feels like it was a long time ago. So it's definitely a journey that has a lot of lessons to be learned. When you think back on the totality of your coaching career, what is something that you feel like you were really good at right from the beginning as a coach? I know you mentioned it a couple of times when you were talking about being a high school coach and being 21 or 22 or 23 and thinking you knew it all, but there was probably some piece of it that you were pretty good at right from the beginning. And then maybe what's something that when you look back on it, you're like, "Ugh, I was really bad at that. But now I feel like maybe I'm not great at it, but I've gotten a lot better at a particular aspect of coaching." So something that you were maybe naturally good at, and then something that you've really had to work at to improve.
Yeah. I mean, there's obviously a lot. And I'm still improving in a ton and don't know what I don't know if I know if I'm great at anything, but what I learned right away for sure is that I needed to be myself, because I tried to be my dad my first year as a head coach. I tried to run the offense as he ran. I tried to run the defense as he ran, which I knew everything about. I tried to coach the way he coached. I tried to, you know, the verbiage I used, the messaging I used, how I tried to get across to players was all very similar, and I don't think it worked. And I really reevaluated myself between those first 2 years and said, "Listen, what, like, go back to the, when I was coaching," and I didn't mention this before, but I would go back when I was in college and I would coach the high school team in the summer league. And I was more myself then than ever, because there was no expectations, right? It's the summer league. I'm a college student. No one cares who I am. I'm coaching guys that I'm pretty close in age with, but it worked. And we were really good in those summers. And I thought I got across to him because I was just myself. So my second year as a head coach, I became myself, which is still similar to my dad, but not the same. that was a big thing I had to learn. It's just kind of being true to who I was, which it seems kind of generic and when you say it, but it's a hard thing to do because we all have favorite coaches and people we look up to and we want to be like them. But you can't mimic them to a T. You still got to be your own person and put your own twist on it. So I had to do that. And what I learned that second year is maybe what I was good at was the ability to get across a point to a player in a certain way without, I don't know why or how, but just putting it in terms individually, like I could kind of read a kid. This kid learns in a different way than this kid. And maybe that was my third grade teaching background, is I'd have to get across to this kid differently than another kid. And I think I'm still decent at that. I think it's something I do well. I'm able to take Coach Smith's message and get it across to a kid one-on-one, maybe in the way he needs it. And I try to be really good at that. And I hope that's what I'm good at. I think it's, if I ever get the opportunity to be a head coach at the collegiate level, I think it's going to be something I really try to keep with me, and not lose sight of. Things that I need to get better at is recognizing, from there to now, and I think I've gotten better, is recognizing what my team needs. Because it's not always what we think it is as a coach. Sometimes you need to take a step back and realize, hey, I want my team to do this so well, but that's not what they need to be good at. This team is going to be really good because they rebound well, or this team's going to be really good because they defend. That's because that's who they are. So let me, as a coach, make them that versus molding them into what I want them to be, if that makes sense.
No, it makes total sense.
I needed to recognize that not every team's going to be the same. And my high school coach, Jay Reese, he taught me that. And I didn't realize it until we talked later in life, but he was good at that. What three things is this team going to be really good at? And those three things aren't the same year to year. They're going to be different next year from this year. And that's something I continue to try to get better at, and I still don't know that I'm good at it.
That's something that you got to take your ego off the table, because as a coach, oftentimes we think that the way our system, our philosophy, what we believe in, that obviously there are some core values that don't change. But when you talk about mm-hmm. trying to fit what you do to your team, that's something that the best coaches, I think, do well, is they're able to adjust and look at and say, okay, this year I have a more defensive minded team, or this year we can get up and down and run and press. Yep. And that kind of thing. And then, hey, another year, hey, we got a lot of bigs in our team. Maybe we need to get the ball inside more, or whatever it might be. I think good coaches do a really good job of figuring out and understanding their personnel. And it's really hard to do. And I think a lot of coaches, just as you described, sometimes struggle with that, because you have like, hey, I think, I'm of the philosophy that, we got to be a great rebounding team in order to win. But maybe your team isn't a great rebounding team. Maybe you just need to be a team that gets up and down and shoots threes and gets the other team to turn the ball over. And that's how you create more possessions, or whatever it may be. And I think it's just a really good point. I think it's a lesson that all coaches can learn. Go ahead.
Well, what's hard as a coach, just along those points, is we don't like to teach what we don't know, right?
For sure.
Like we get scared of it. We kind of take a step back, or we want to say we know it. We're in the back of our head, we know we don't, or the players are going to recognize it. Like, this guy's trying to talk about something he don't really know about. Well, just be clear about it. Like, I remember between those 2 years as being a head coach at Fort Loramie, is we completely changed our offense. My dad's a five out guy, or was at the time. And I needed to change, and I completely changed to kind of the B-line two guard hybrid offense that he ran at West Virginia. And it took me, like, I had to humble myself a little bit. Like, I don't know as much about this game as I think I do. And I'm going to tell my players that. And I did. And I told them, and I said, I'm going to relearn this offense, because this is, looking at you guys and taking a step back and the personnel we have, this is going to be the offense that makes us much better. And we changed from a matchup zone to man-to-man defense, because my dad was a good matchup zone guy. I thought I was, but those kids didn't fit it. And I had to be transparent with them about that. And I think, that transparency and honesty with my players went a long way, because they knew what I was going through and what I was trying to learn. And it made me more comfortable in teaching it, because we made some mistakes teaching it, but I listened to my players, and when they say, hey coach, this isn't working, like maybe this part doesn't fit or whatever. And we were able to take a step back together as a team. and revamp it and make it work for us. And we were much better that second year, like not even close.
Yeah. I mean, that makes all the sense in the world when you think about, you can't be an expert in everything. And so as you go through, if you're going to try something new, obviously they're just like, there's a learning curve for players. There's a learning curve for you as a coach. And not only do you have to understand it for yourself, but you also have to understand it well enough that you can teach it and demonstrate it and get your team to be able to execute it, which oftentimes that's two different things. Like, you may be able to understand it, but then you step out on the floor and trying to explain it in such a way that it's coherent for your players and they can only execute it. It's that old saying, right? That you can, they really haven't learned until they haven't learned anything until you, until they've shown that they can do it. And
exactly.
And so you can teach it all you want, but if they can't demonstrate and can't actually do it, you're, you know, you're kind of putting your team in a bad position. So it's a learning process as a coach. And I think that's really, critical. I want to wrap up by asking you one final two-part question. It's one that I oftentimes end the podcast with, and that is, when you look ahead over the next year or two, what's your biggest challenge that you see ahead of you? And what's your biggest joy when you think about what you get to do every day, getting up out of bed in the morning and you go into your office? What brings you the most joy? So your biggest challenge, your biggest joy?
I'll start with the challenges, is High Point. We don't have a huge, we don't have a great tradition at High Point. And because we've only been Division I since 2000 and we've had a couple down years. So the challenge for us is getting this thing turned around under Coach Smith's vision, which we're working really hard to. And it's a challenge. Super fun, hard, but it's going to be very rewarding because we're on the right path. And then that, the challenge in it is, in this profession, your job security, everyone knows, isn't the best. So you got to be able to wake up every day and go full throttle at it without thinking about that. That's a challenge for me. Since I was on a staff that got fired, it's a challenge every day to go to work full throttle and realize that it can be pulled away in a second, kind of out of the blue, which is hard. Because I never thought about it when I got into coaching. But that is a challenge for me personally, and a challenge for any coach, really, that whether some coaches it bothers more than others. But that's hard for me. And then there's many challenges, but that's one that sticks out to me a lot. And I talk to people a lot about, a joy I get is one, I have somewhat of a routine now. I wake up in the morning and I love coffee, and I make a great pour over coffee and sit with my wife for 15 to 30 minutes in the morning and get to talk with her about our day and goals or whatever we might be talking about. And I love that. That is something that it's taken a long time for us to get to a point in this coaching journey that we were able to have some time like that. We've done a great job of spending time together and navigating this thing, but now we have some consistency in it on the days that I'm home outside of games and recruiting that we get to do. And I love that every single day.
And you got a table and chair, and chairs to sit at,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so got a couple.
Nice.
I got a couple, so that makes coffee even more enjoyable.
Absolutely.
And then I get to come to an office where we just build a $180 million arena and work for a coach that should be in the Hall of Fame, and be around young people that I still try to stay connected with. The older I get, they stay the same age, right? So I got to try to – I love the joy of trying to keep that youthfulness in my life and stay up with them and learn from them, because of all the technology we talked about early on in this deal, I'm trying to keep up, and I really enjoy learning from them and then trying to give them some thoughts to mold that new technology and the new way of life, you know, based on what I've been able to do or learn or, you know, see along the way. I love that part of it. Just as much as I love watching film. I mean, I love basketball. That's what I said. You got to love basketball to do this. And coming in to think about practice to get better and watching to do scouts. And like, I love all that. So there's many joys throughout the day for me. Why there's a ton of challenges in this job, as difficult as it can be, and the demands it takes. Like, if you don't really sit down and think about the joys it brings you, like you're asking me about, which I try to do and be grateful for every day. And as you get older, you get better at that. It's challenging and joyful all at the same time, and you have to love every minute of it.
That's good stuff, and it makes sense. I think anybody who's in a profession that they love feels that same way, that it wouldn't be interesting and exciting if it wasn't challenging. Mm-hmm. And yet you also do sometimes get caught up in forgetting about the joys of why you do it, just because you're in that sort of day-to-day hustle and bustle of what you're trying to accomplish. So I think that was very well said. And Eric, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule today to jump on and join us. Really appreciate it. Before we get out, I want to give you a chance, share how people can find out more about you, where they can reach out to you, whether you want to share social media, email, whatever. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah. Yeah. Feel free to email me. My email is just egabriel@highpoint.edu, which is simple. That's directly to me. And then probably the easiest way is on Twitter @CoachGabriel. That's really the one that I probably check the most. I have other social media, but I'm not on there much. So @CoachGabriel, I'm always willing to reply there, and then we can make connections from that. And then the last thing I'll say before we get off here, Mike, is the one thing I've been really fortunate about as I go through this story, and every time I tell it to someone and I think about it, is, and I know I can get long-winded, so I'll keep it short, is the amount of good people I've had around me has been second to none. And I hadn't necessarily known that when I was going through this of picking and choosing who was around me. But now that I look back, I think I was doing a good job. One, I was lucky enough to have great parents, which is, you know, we don't always get to choose that, but I was super fortunate. Then I had great grandparents and aunts and uncles and everybody around me. Even though I said I was a first generation college student, still didn't mean that education wasn't important and being successful in whatever I wanted to do. And they allowed me to kind of go my own way as long as I was doing it the right way. But then what I did was I had a high school coach that was great. And then I surrounded myself with friends that were great and successful. And then I chose to work for people that were great. And some of it was luck, some of it was choice. But if you have a choice to put yourself around great people and be connected with great people, and sometimes it takes work to get involved and get those people in your circle, do it. Like, and it doesn't matter if it's basketball or not, any part of life. That's what I'm most thankful about looking back is the Alan Bolin that I had as a coach and the Jay Reese's and my dad. And I could name names. I could go on and on and on. And Nathan Hale, who was part of my life, and my mom, who's the most influential non-basketball person I could ever be around. And then I got Coach Smith and Coach Cherry and Coach Joey Higginbotham and David. I mean, all these names I'm telling you are great, great people that influenced me. And Larry Ludlow at Fort Laramie. I could just keep going as they pop in my head. Unbelievable people that I was so lucky to kind of connect with throughout the way, not to mention the players that I'm still close with. Like, that's what's the best part about it when you look back. That's what's best about any of this coaching stuff we do, right? Or really any profession, is those relationships. It's kind of cliche now, but that's the truth. Like, young people need to understand that, because when we're young, we don't. That those relationships are incredible and they're going to benefit you for forever. And when I get fired again, which will probably happen, like I did the first, like those people, I hadn't talked to Coach Reese, my high school coach, in years. Well, maybe not years. We had talked, but there was no ill will. But when I got fired, he was one of the first people I talked to. And he helped me get on with Coach Smith. Like, some of the stuff he told me and some of the stuff I did was because of him. Like, that stuff is, you can't put a value on it. And that's all outside of my wife or your partner, whoever you have with you, that's the closest person to help you through those moments. Those are priceless.
Ultimately, it's a relationship business. I think that you said it very well, that you want to cultivate those relationships. When you're young, you don't realize the value of those mm-hmm. relationships. And a lot of times too, when you're young, the people that you have relationships aren't yet in a position where they may eventually be able to help you. And as you get older, you get more and more friends, more and more relationships of people who have moved up, whether it's the coaching ladder or whatever profession you may be in. And ultimately, those relationships are the ones that help you. And if you remember that those relationships are a two-way street, that not only can somebody help you, but if you're also willing to reach your hand out and help somebody else, that's when you really see the magic in those relationships. And I think that's well said. It's a really good way for us to wrap this up. And again, Eric, I just wanted to say thanks to you for the time. Your story is one that certainly resonated with me. I think it's something that resonates with a lot of coaches who have gone through similar experiences or maybe are hoping to go through a similar experience to what you've been able to do. And I wish you nothing but the best moving forward. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.